This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You have reached the edge of the world. Today on Dreamland, I'm going to be doing something new. I'm going to be just talking. I'm not going to interview anyone today. The reason is that there is so much going on and so much in the past that is being forgotten that I want to discuss these things. Also, I am going to be in the subscriber video room on Saturdays. There will be announcements in the newsletter, so please open the newsletter, and you can ask me questions about these shows after we run them. I'm also in the subscriber chat room every Wednesday night at 7, and subscribers are more than welcome to join me there. Before we get into what I'm going to be talking about today, I'd like to also mention that I'm going to be at Contact in the Desert this year from May the 31st through June the 2nd. I'm going to be doing a lecture, an intensive, and a workshop, all three. Those who attend the intensive will receive a free copy of the collector's edition of The Key, signed by me. I will have books available to sell, signed copies of, I think I'll have some signed copies of Them, of Communion, of course, and of The Fourth Mind. And incidentally, if you go to the unknowncountry.com store, you can get signed copies of these books now. I'm going to be lecturing on living with the unknown. I live with it in this apartment, and there's plenty of video to back that claim up. And you will see some of it in this lecture, and it's quite amazing. It's been a really remarkable ride I've been on all of these years. In the workshop, I'm going to get into something I discuss in The Fourth Mind, which is the anatomy, genetics, and spiritual beliefs of the visitors we know as the Greys. And you'll find out during the lecture exactly why I can do this. And it's also in the new book, in The Fourth Mind. You can get The Fourth Mind, by the way, hardcover, softcover, Kindle, and audiobook. The other thing I'm going to do in the intensive is about recovering our lost powers. The visitors can levitate. They can, goodness knows, they can walk through walls. A few weeks ago, they took a friend of mine by the arm and dragged this person up through the ceiling of her home. And this is not uncommon, and it happens to people in my life, especially people who are working with me, fairly frequently. So it's real. It's as simple as that. And we're having all kinds of trouble dealing with this. In any case, if you're coming to Contact in the Desert, you know I'm approachable. Don't hang back. I'll want to talk to you just as much as you want to talk to me. And I will certainly welcome you in all three of my presentations there. There are lots of other great people coming too. Linda Moulton Howe will be there. Oh my goodness, so many. I can't even name them all. But now let's go on. Let's move on into this issue of what I'd like to talk about today. And I'd like to set some basic groundwork. Right now, everyone is flocking to podcasts that have people like Jake Barber on them. Who has talked about shooting at the visitors and then retrieving objects that they successfully shot down, and others, psionics experts who talk about how they can draw these orbs. Well, you can too, and it's free. You don't have to pay anyone anything to do it. And all you have to do is find a place where you've got a lot of sky and just ask. The other thing, another thing is that's because the visitors are very fluently telepathic. And in a later show, or maybe even later in this show, I don't know, I'm going to be talking about telepathy and giving you some suggestions about how those of us who are voiced can also become telepathic. And that does not mean listening in on your friends and enemies' internal conversations and sex fantasies or whatever. It's a very different thing from that in some ways, but not in all. Okay, so let's get into them. What is the difference between us and the visitors? Now, you're not going to hear this from anybody else. And the reason you're not is that they haven't had much contact, or any in many cases. There's one guy out there, supposedly an expert, saying the visitors have a language and he knows about it. No, they don't. They don't have a language. They do not speak words at all. That's not how they operate. They do it a different way, and we're going to get into that in a minute. They do have a written language. It's hieroglyphics. And I see these hieroglyphics all the time. It's quite fascinating. In fact, I'm showing you just now an image of a building in New York. I was in a friend's flat spending the night, and up and down the walls of that building in the dead of the night, there were two immense strips of glowing orange hieroglyphics. And I was, understand, wide awake. I could see these. I can't tell you that other people could see them. No one mentioned them. My friend was in another, who I was staying with, was in another part of the flat, was slept through the whole thing. So I don't know. I do not know. I, however, was able to pick up my camera and take a picture because it was real. Now, you think, oh, finally, what a great idea. Finally gets a picture of something truly unusual. Well, what happened was, this is the picture I took out of that same window when those hieroglyphs were hanging there. It's the color of the hieroglyphs, but it's all completely washed out. There's nothing there to no detail. But what is there? There is something very wrong. Building this image coming from the same camera, same iPhone, out the same window, it shows for sure there is something going on there. And in the lecture and contact, we talk about more things that are going on and have more video. In any case, so they have these hieroglyphics. I can't read them. They are incredibly intricate. I don't think I can reproduce them. I have seen numerous reproductions of hieroglyphics, allegedly alien hieroglyphics, but they are nowhere near as intricate as the ones I actually see with my own eyes. For example, the ones I see with my own eyes have variations in intensity in the lines, meaning that they have different meanings. Two identical glyphs, or apparently identical glyphs, they're so complex I can't tell you for sure, but that look identical, may be glowing in a different way. I think that means they have a different meaning or different nuances of meaning. In any case, they are far more sophisticated than any kind of writing we do here on Earth. And I include the glyphic languages like Japanese and Indonesian and Sanskrit and, of course, Chinese. They're much more remarkably complex than that. Now, I'll get into why they are more complex in another lecture when we begin to talk a little bit about the anatomy and brains of the visitors. I'm going to certainly be talking a lot about that at contact. What I want to talk about basically today is where the current material that's being talked about by people who have had encounters with them on an official level. They can't talk about this because they haven't been that close. Maybe there are people within the government somewhere who haven't spoken out who have been as close as I've been. I don't know. But the visitors do not have any vocal equipment that will enable them to form words. They don't have a syrinx, which would enable them to form sounds like a bird. And they do not have vocal cords, which would enable them to form complex language like we do. They can make sounds, though. And these sounds are absolutely remarkable. I have heard them scream a couple of times, cry out in anguish. And I assure you, that is not a sound you ever want to hear. It is a terrible, terrible sound. A sound of anguish and pain beyond anything you can imagine. It goes right through you like a hot bolt of lightning that doesn't stop. The circumstances I have heard that particular cry of anguish in are very personal. All I can say is they have toweringly powerful emotions. The taller, 5 foot tall ones do. The little short ones are not playing with a full deck. Put it that way. They are not playing with a full deck. They are, I'll tell you what I think they are, is they are biological machines. And I think that they're judging from the very complex brains these little 3 foot tall ones have. The taller ones can actually project their own consciousness into this brain and use it as a, use the biorobot out in the world. That's why these people like Jake Barber say they can shoot them down, because they don't care. They don't care if they're killed. Then they're giving these to us. I think that a great deal of the UFO crashes, the bodies that we have, all of that are donations, including the bodies. The bodies aren't tragedies. The bodies are simply expendable biorobots that they gave to us in order to teach us more about themselves. And why would they do it that way? Well, there's one big reason. They can't talk. They can't talk. They can't do it. But I can talk. And for those of you on the free side, you might have hoped that I would forget the ads and the commercials, but I have not. So watch this ad about the fourth mind. And think about buying it. And watch the beautiful ad about the stars and unknowncountry.com and the extraordinary adventure and romance that is involved in participating in this very, very remarkable website. One of a kind. We'll be right back. Today, I'm talking about the visitors and vocalization and the differences between them and us. They do not have a spoken language. They simply don't. They don't have a spoken language. As I said earlier, it's because they don't have vocal cords. They don't have a syrinx, so they can't speak. They can't make any sounds at all, in fact, except a cry. I talked about the cry of anguish, which I've heard. I don't believe I've ever talked about it before. There are other cries. There is a sound of, I guess, of disappointment that's much gentler and more beautiful. This comes always from the ones that are about 5 foot tall, who I believe to be fully biological beings. I don't know that the smaller ones can make any sound at all. I would think they could make similar sounds. I'm pretty sure they can. But let's put it this way. I've never heard them do that. And because I haven't heard it, means I'm not going to speculate about it. It's like I don't speculate about reptilians. I don't speculate about anything I have not personally laid my eyes on. That means I speculate about tall whites. I've laid my eyes on them. Two tall whites and one of their children. And Nordics. I have had a conversation with a Nordic, and it was a physical conversation. Therefore, at least this Nordic could speak. And I can't discount the idea, excuse me, I can't discount the idea that the Greys could learn to speak. They're very inventive when it comes to genetics, and they could conceivably create a genetically altered version of one of themselves that can speak. I know they've created human, I presume, gray hybrids, or they're certainly human beings who are fluently telepathic just like them, but who cannot speak. I know they can't speak because I've been with them, and they are not able to speak. They're not able to make any tones that I heard either. They're able to cry out in alarm, basically, when somebody who can do telepathy with them shows up and suddenly there's a stranger in their midst who is talking to them up here, and they are thinking, oh, God, and what you hear is, ah, like that. And then in the case that that happened, this poor woman, little woman, terrified of me, ran. I wish that wouldn't happen. You know, I'm a very gentle soul. I'm never going to hurt anybody. I don't think I've lost my temper since I was 10 years old. I don't have an angry gene. I don't get that way. I'm very mild-mannered. And I think, you know, talking to a lot of you guys are probably close encounter witnesses and abductees like me, and you're thinking to yourselves, gee, I don't get mad either. Yeah, you were chosen for a reason. If you get a group of us together, you find that we're mostly extremely mild people. And the reason is simple. The visitors are short and fragile and probably not very strong by comparison with us. And they don't want violent people. In fact, I remember my first abduction. They had trouble with me. It's my only abduction, actually, that I remember. They had trouble with me, big trouble. They were running around, and I was screaming and trying to get up off that couch or table or bed or whatever it was, and they were having a fit. And they turned on this machine, as you know, you've heard the story probably many times, that kept saying to me, what can we do to help you stop screaming? And his answer was, you know, since I was in a room full of giant insects and I couldn't move, not a lot. What I don't talk about, by the way, and I'm just going to do this as an aside right now. Now, I'll get into this. I'm going to get into the vocalization thing later. But if you're going to sit here and listen to me talk, you're going to find that I move around a lot in subjects. I go around here and there and everywhere exploring as I go down the roads of the mind, all kinds of different nuances and angles. And this particular angle is something that didn't show up in communion because I didn't know it had happened until after I published the book. And that was that one of my neighbors saw the UFO I was in on that night of December the 26th, 1985. He and his wife were driving home from a party in the wee hours of the morning, and they saw what they thought was the Goodyear blimp in a snowy field near our houses. And they were concerned because obviously it's 2 o'clock in the morning or something, a cold winter night. There's no way a Goodyear blimp should be out in the middle of nowhere, down on the ground. It had to be in trouble. So the husband got out and started, crossed a little fence that's there and started walking through the snow toward it. He hadn't gone too far before suddenly lights turned on all over it and began to, as he ran, walked toward it, he heard screaming inside and began to run toward it. Then lights turned on all over it and it started to make a growling noise and go toward him. He withdrew, understandably, got in his car, got the hell out of there. I would have done the same. Who wouldn't have? God, it's horrifying. It's absolutely horrifying. In any case, a year later, he read the book and he came over to the house and he said, Whitley, I just want to tell you, I'm pretty sure I saw that happen. And he told me the story I've just told you. And I said to him, he said, I am so ashamed of the fact that I did not try to help you. I said, you're very lucky. Because those cats mean business. And I don't think it would have been a good idea to try to help me. Anyway, I'm here and I'm safe now. And we parted company, but we didn't see each other much after that. We sort of separated somehow. It was funny the way we did that. That happens a lot in this experience. People have experiences together, and then they kind of drift apart and never see each other again. Anyway, I don't know if he's even alive or dead anymore. I'm very privileged, I think, to be able to go up to the cabin now, like, from time to time, because the new owner of it has respect for me, and they want me there. I'm not wanted in a lot of places, but I'm wanted there. And I love that little family so much and so grateful to them. And it's a lovely, I'm not going to tell you their names, and I'm not going to tell you where the cabin is, of course. I wish I could, but that's not a good idea. And because you're listening and you're a wonderful person, but who might be out there? Who might be out there? You know, I'm going to segue again, I think. I promise you, we will get to the vocalization issue eventually. But here's an interesting segue about who may be out there. And I had Gregory Kane on this show. He's a psychic who works at the Lilydale Assembly in upstate New York. That's the summer camp of the Spiritualist Church of America, where I spoke a couple of years ago. And gosh, I wish they'd invite me back. I enjoyed that so much. It was such a glorious occasion. I love Lilydale, the Lilydale Assembly, it's called. It's very much part of my heart. In any case, Ann and I used to go there. We would stay at the Chautauqua Institution and go and spend a few days at Lilydale every summer. And we would go to see psychics. They have all got houses there and all kinds of psychics. And if you read up on the Spiritualist Church of America's techniques for proving whether or not a person is psychic, you will find they are very serious about confirming mediumship. You can't just become a Spiritualist Church of America medium because you want to or you think you can. You have to pass stringent tests. So it's a pretty reliable place. Now, mediumship is always kind of iffy. You might not connect with a given medium, or you might connect. I connected with Gregory Kane, and I still love the man. I so enjoyed meeting him again when I went there a couple of years ago, and then having him on my show, it was just lovely. And I hope if I go there again, I certainly, the first person I would want to see would be Greg. In any case, I'm doing this reading with him, and all of a sudden, he says, do you remember the time your car suddenly stopped? Out of nowhere. And I'm amazed. I hadn't thought about it in a year, maybe more. And I say, well, yes, Greg, I do remember that. I remember it very well, now that you mention it. We had a brand new Volvo, beautiful car, and they was not a car that was in the habit of stopping without warning, believe me. We had been with some friends in Putnam County in New York State, which is a little bit south of where we lived in Ulster County. we'd come up the highway from Putnam County and then taken a crossroad that led to the New York State Thruway, where we would have turned north and gone farther north. There was a toll plaza. We were approaching the toll plaza when the car stopped. It turned off. The lights, all the red lights went on, and I had to struggle with the now steering wheel with no power and steering and get it rolled off to the side of the road. And said, "What happened?" I said, "I don't know what happened. It just stopped." I tried the key and just wouldn't go. And I thought, "Oh boy, I'm going to have to take a walk because." And I thought, I said, the toll plaza looked about a mile ahead. And so I said, "I'm going to have to walk up to the toll plaza and get him to make a call and give us a tow." This is before cell phones. And so I tried one more time, and the car started. And we went home. And we didn't say anything about it to a soul. I mean, why would we? And it's not a subject of conversation. My car stopped for a few minutes on the highway. Oh, gee, let's talk about that. I don't think so. So we forgot about it. Then here I am with Gregory Keene all this time later, and suddenly he brings it up. And I knew at that moment, whatever was going on, this psychic was in me, in my head. He was with me. And so I said it had stopped. And then he says, "That car was stopped by your guardian angel." By your guardian angel? I have a guardian angel. Now I'm scared because I know I have a guardian angel, and I'm very much afraid that when I pass on and arise out of here, that my guardian angel is going to say, "Oh, thank heavens," and be pissed off at me for giving him so much trouble. Anyway, that's neither here nor there. Or it's sort of here and there. It will be probably in the future. Anyway, he said, "Your guardian angel turned the car off because there was someone coming up the thruway. And if they had seen you, they would have followed you home and murdered both of you." Our son wasn't with us at the time. He was in high school and boarding school. And my blood ran cold. My blood ran cold. And I thought, can I believe this? This is so strange. What is going on here? And then we forgot about it. We didn't think about it. And I said to Gregory, "Well, I have no sense of having a guardian angel." And as I said that, I remember seeing in my mind's eye this tall column of light above me. And I thought to myself, you know, Whitley, you put out streetlights. Could that be your guardian angel trying to keep up with you? And a lot of you do too. You walk under streetlights and they just go out. In any case, I told Annie about it. And then our son showed up and we were driving the same Volvo through Lilydale very slowly because you can only drive on certain roads. It's mostly walking and bicycles. And one of the roads you can drive on. And I told him this story. And I said to him, "And I guess I do have a guardian angel." And at that moment, the car did exactly the same thing. It stopped dead. Now you listen up here. Do you understand what I'm telling you? I think you probably have a guardian angel, maybe more than one. We're not alone here, is the lesson for this. Someone loves you and me. Even though my guardian angel is my guardian angel, I think they still love me. I hope they do. And that would be really fun in a way. I'd love to be a guardian angel in the future, but I'd like to be a guardian angel of a whole bunch of people. I like people. I love people. That's why I want this world to live. That's why I went out on a limb with War Day and got criticized, and went out on a limb with Superstorm and got told, nah, that's all stupid. Went out on a limb with Nature's End and went down and to assembled group of environmental reporters in Washington, and they all scoffed at me. Fire burn the Amazon, impossible. All these fires you have in it and California and Los Angeles, that's never going to happen. All these storms you talk about in Superstorm. If you live anywhere in the center of the United States, you might remember Superstorm is damn real. And it's we're going farther and farther down that road every single day. Every day. The visitors told me 5 years ago, we had 7 years left before we became unable to change the situation to do anything about what the planet's going to do. So we have, 5 years left. And we have made a decision in the most polluting country in the world, the United States, that we will do nothing about it at all for the next 4 years. And not only that, we will roll back as much of what we have done in the past as we can. And we will have to live with that. All of us, not just in America, but in the world. The great polluters on the planet are the United States, India, and China. China at least pays lip service to it, but they don't actually, their emissions don't actually decline that much, so it's probably mostly paperwork. India aggressively refuses to do a thing about it, and now so does the United States. So basically, whatever's going to happen is going to happen, and we're here, and we have to live it. We have to. It's our lives, and we have to live it. What do I think will happen? Well, I think there'll be increasing disruptions to the point where it's going to get hard to live here, and I wouldn't be surprised to see significant changes that result in extensive famines and things like that. So I don't like to talk about that. Let's talk about fun things. Let's talk about things that matter in that sense. And maybe, just maybe, we will find a way out of this dilemma that we are in. Because remember, it's nobody's fault. It's population. Just people, too many people. And we are designed to do that. We are not like the other animals. We don't have sexual seasonality. We're ready for sex anytime. We are naked. We don't have fur or hair covering anything on our bodies. We have great big genitals and beautiful, beautiful bodies. And children are a valuable commodity in human society, or have been until recently. So, yeah. The planet is overpopulated. Now, who made us? Well, it's one of the things we're going to talk about, because there's some very interesting books. Greg Braden's got a fascinating book out. It's a bit dated, but I'm working with this whole issue of where are we designed, or did we just happen? And as far as I'm concerned, the jury's still out. I don't know where I am with this. But you'll see some interviews over the course of the next year on this show where we will be talking about that. And now we're going to be talking about another break. Free Dreamlanders love it. Okay, Free Dreamlanders, we're back, and subscribers, you had the delicious pleasure of not watching the very beautiful commercials that we ran. Now, let's go on. I'm going to finally circle back to this issue of vocalizations. And I do circle back. Don't forget that. This is actually a very well-organized talk. If you put it through ChatGPT or something like that, you'll find that's the case. In any case, speaking of cases, The visitors do not have vocalization. They communicate telepathically. They are a non-vocal species. We are a vocal species. It is abundantly clear to me that nobody who has spoken about them publicly from people coming from the inside has any idea about this. Now, as I said before, I'm not saying that there's nobody on the inside who hasn't had contact with them. I know that is not the case because I knew one man who did have extensive contact with them. He's died, but I knew him well. And it's really complicated. We hardly ever met face to face, but we were very much in the same world. Oh, there's so much. You know, one of the things I wish I could talk about things like that, but I'm not constrained by security clearances or government or anything. I have no clearances. I was asked to get a clearance back in the 90s, and I said no. And the reason is very simple. If I had a security clearance, everything I wrote would have to be vetted by the CIA. And I don't think you would have seen a single one of the books that have emerged out of me since then if I had a clearance. I don't think they would have allowed any of them, especially not the Fourth Mind. Boy, is that a baddie as far as they're concerned. They don't talk about it because they don't want you to think about that, but this is the case. It's a baddie. Now, we have, each of us, a completely separate brain, mind, and consciousness. We are voiced. We communicate through the air with voices, and now through the ether and the atmosphere in all kinds of different ways. And we're learning how to communicate instantaneously across vast distances using quantum signaling. If we can ever get that to work in a stable way, you're remarkable. In any case, we are physical communicators. We communicate only in the physical world. The visitors are not. They are non-physical communicators. They are unvoiced. They communicate via telepathy. And it's wonderful. And many of you who are listening to this or watching me sit here and talk will know this. You have had telepathic experiences with the visitors. But we are the experiencers. We are the woo factor, as they call us, the outsiders. No one wants us in the conversation. They want this conversation to be scientists and officials discussing this. Any one of you knows more than the scientists and the officials ever will, because they are not part of this experience. They're outsiders looking in. And I'm not complaining. They need to do it this way, because look at what happens in Wikipedia. They are on a tear. Gary Nolan's foundation, the Soul Foundation, created by Gary, one of the nation's leading scientists, often proposed for a Nobel Prize. Wikipedia is trying to remove the Soul Foundation Wikipedia entry and basically boulderize Gary's entry. You know what that's called? It's called ontological shock. ontological shock. That means people fearing the shock of the new. And I guess I'm going to get into that in a little while, but I don't want to get off the vocalization issue. We vocalize. We are independent inside ourselves. We don't have ready telepathy. The visitors have never, I don't think they've ever had anything except telepathy. Maybe in some very distant past it was different. I don't know how they've evolved. But They have only telepathy now. They cannot speak. Some of their vocalizations are incredibly rich, and I can get to that. I've talked about that so often, though, I don't want to bring it up again because you've heard the stories. But just to say this, that I did have an experience with them in which one of them uttered cries that were so beautiful, so moving, and so perfectly spaced that they just went right through me. But also, the perfection of them was so great that I couldn't, music for a year afterwards sounded muddy to me, even the very finest music, because those cries, those sounds, those three sounds I heard were so perfectly spaced and uttered with such extraordinary precision. You know, I think to myself sometimes, could we be dealing here with a brilliant, deeply emotional machine? Is that what this is? Because they're not emotional. They're very emotional. Okay. So they are telepathic and they're joined telepathically. Now you're going to hear people who have never been in their telepathic bubble, as it were, say the disgusting words, hive mind. It's no hive mind at all. It is an incredibly complex, subtle, nuanced mind. And all of the 5 foot tall ones have separate personalities, but they are all part of this same mind. This makes them very precise, very careful, very conservative, and not very creative. They are not very creative. I've never seen paintings, imagery, heard music, even color. And well, in the fourth mind, I get into why they don't have color in their world, because their eyes work differently. They don't actually have color vision to any great extent, even less than a dog or a cat. But they have all kinds of vision into the infrared and possibly even the ultraviolet. I don't know. I had a friend who had an abduction experience I referred to earlier. It was dragged out through the ceiling of their bedroom. Well, they were completely conscious, by the way. They weren't unconscious. Afterwards, they ended up with 2 hours of missing time, but that's another story. In any case, I don't know if you will remember this. You probably won't. Dr. Roger Lear discovered or found out one way or another, I don't remember how, that a little light that shines ultraviolet light, which is what this is, a black light, will cause a fluorescence from their fingerprints. And in this lady's flat, there was a curtain with some brown stuff on it and some similar brown stuff on a wall in her bedroom, which didn't really belong in either place. The curtain didn't fluoresce on the curtain, but the part on the wall fluoresced brightly. It was a smear of some kind left by them. I'd love to get it tested, but the problem is this. If you go to a lab, you can't necessarily get the truth, because as soon as they find out what they're testing, they're going to protect the lab's reputation by lying. It's a problem. I have some of the materials from Roswell, just a little tiny bit of it. But what's the use of giving it up? If you give it to like the Army Corps of Engineers, you're never going to hear anything about it again. If you take it to a laboratory, you can't tell whether or not they're going to tell you the truth. So I don't know what to do with it. And I've had people come forward, oh, we will tell you the truth, but how do I know that? I don't. Some of it back in the 90s, I was very tight with Dr. William Mallow, the head of material science at Southwest Research in San Antonio. Then I gave some of this material to some Navy people who had a lab in Groton, Connecticut, I believe, and they said that they would send it back to me, and I never heard from them again. So the little piece I still have left, I don't intend to give away. I don't know what I'll. In it, they are. I don't think they've ever had a war, because how could they? They are a single entity. They may have had conflicts with other entities outside of their psychic space, but not among themselves. And I think they're kind of confused by us. I think they're moving very slowly here. And we think always, well, they must have been here for thousands of years. And that may or may not be true. My thought is that we probably have been visited many times. And most of the time, they've given up. And they've given up because we couldn't understand what they were. If you read Ezekiel's wheel, it's a chariot. It's or the ancient gods, Hathor and Job, Hathor and Osiris and Isis and the god of Abraham and the Roman gods and the Greek gods and the gods of the Hindus, all of these gods, they're not. The visitors were probably responsible for our creating these gods. In other words, we saw something we didn't understand and decided it was something more than us, of being a god, because here they can fly and do all kinds of extraordinary things. And of course, they must be gods. And therefore, they couldn't communicate with us because they didn't have any significant ability to vocalize. They couldn't make themselves understood, and they would leave. And I think they've come and gone, not necessarily the same cultures, have come and gone quite a few times over the course of human history. But the Greys are here now. There are others here. There's still some tall whites here, I think. I haven't had any contact with the Nordics in over 20 years, so I don't know if they're still here. They may be just not interested in having contact with me. I don't know. In any case, they see here that every individual is an island unto themselves. Each of us is a separate being. And this is something that they are not familiar with. They are absolutely not familiar with at all. I don't think they understand a lot of things. I don't think they understand art. I don't think they understand, know what color is. I certainly don't think they understand music. But there may be others here who do. I'm talking about the ones I'm relating to, that I am with. When I am with them, which is very infrequent. I don't want you to think I'm sitting down across a table from them and chatting. Far from it. The few times I have been with the Greys, I have been completely comfortable telepathically. And if you go to the communion letters, which are now housed at the Archives of the Impossible at Rice University, you will find that many people are comfortable with telepathy with the visitors. And you probably would be too. I don't think it takes, I think it's, as I say in the fourth mind, I think it's an ability we all have, but it is atrophied and can be brought back, I would think. In any case, because they are this way, their understanding of the world is absolutely fundamentally different from ours. We see each person as a very complex individual. We care much more about death. We're much more careful with our bodies than they are. Although I will say that the 5 foot tall ones are outraged when their bodies are injured. In one of Kathleen Martin's books, it's either in Extraterrestrial Contact or the Alien Abduction Files, there is a remarkable story of a man who owned a little airport, a private airport. And there's such a romance to these private airports. They're all over the place, actually. They're sort of a dying breed. But anyway, he owned a private airport, and he lived in the above the hangar in a his little, he had a little office and living quarters above the hangar, and there were planes in the hangar and a little runway. And one night, a flying saucer landed at the end of the runway, or came to the end of the runway. And we have come to the end of the first hour. So if you're not a subscriber, you won't get to hear what happened to the poor guy. But it's really fascinating, and I urge you to subscribe to unknowncountry.com. And so do come back anyway. Next week, we're going to have a great show, and on we go with Dreamland. I've been doing this since 1998. It was one of the first podcasts, if not the first podcast. And it remains absolutely unique in the world. There is not another person like me doing this, who is speaking to you with authority from inside a relationship with these other remarkable beings from goodness knows where. Thank you for being with us. In one of Kathleen Martin's books, there occurs this story of the owner of the airline, little airport, and the flying saucer. The flying saucer landed at the end of his runway, his little airport. Of course, he was absolutely fascinated. And he put out all kinds of signs and signals trying to get it to come back, and it did, landing once again at the end of the runway. And he started telling his family about this and had a great deal of trouble. People in the family thought he was gone crazy. And, it's possible that he was already crazy. He was the owner of a private airport in the first place. But nevertheless, he took his mother out there, and an absolutely fascinating thing occurred. They saw at the end of the runway, not when the flying saucer was there, but what appeared to be creatures from the Ice Age, the Permian mammoths and so forth, moving about in the distance. And I've always wondered about this, because if you read my book, A New World, you will know that I had an experience at the Lakota Sioux Reservation, the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota in 2017, before COVID, that it could have been 2016. No, I guess it was 2017 anyway, where I could see another world, entirely different world. If I closed my eyes, I had been riding along in a car with some friends. I was being driven around by various places in the reservation. It was a convention that weekend. I was at that convention. And I closed my eyes. I leaned back and closed my eyes in the car. And I was amazed to see not the roof of the ceiling of the car, but a sky, entirely different sky. And there followed 3 days of being able to see another parallel world whenever I closed my eyes at that reservation. Incredible. And it was clear to me after a while that this, whatever this world is, the Ice Age has not ended there. So when I saw that Kathleen's story, they had seen these mammoths and things from the Ice Age, I thought to myself, what is going on here? where are these UFOs really from? Are they from a parallel universe, a parallel Earth, in which this stuff has, the Ice Age hasn't ended? And is that why they showed up? Because when we blew off the atomic bombs, they were also affected by them? Is that why they showed up? We may return to this in the future, because I will be discussing the question of why they showed up. I do not think the visitors who are here know much about us. I don't think they've been here, as I said earlier, for a long time. I think that many different groups have been here. You know, we have a universe around us that has the amazing number of approximately 21 sextillion planets in it. Now, if we haven't been visited by more than one species, I would be amazed. I would be absolutely amazed. I'm not in ontological shock about the idea of aliens being here, and neither are you. You wouldn't be listening to this show. Of course they are here, and they've been here off and on for years, maybe for the entire history of the planet, for all I know. Any case, here he is, and this happens. And he keeps trying to get that flying saucer back. And one night, he wakes up, and he sees them, these little beings that was obviously the Greys, in his hangar down below his office and sleeping quarters, have a window that enables him to look down into the hangar. And now he's scared. You know, he shouldn't have, you know, you got to be careful what you wish for, because their attitude, I know the Greys, and, you know, they figured he was wanting them to come in. You know, he was inviting them into his house, and they came. So many people write me saying, how do I get them to come into my house? The answer is, I have no idea. They come on their own whenever they wish to, and usually to people, not to people who are asking them to come, but who knows, maybe it'll change. Maybe you should try it. In any case, he hit shining lights and making signals and so forth, and the flying saucer had come a number of times. And finally, there they were in his hangar. And now he's scared. So he gets a gun. And sure enough, he wakes up one night and one of them is standing at the foot of his bed. At the foot of his bed. He is terrified and he shoots it. This being explodes into all kinds of sort of green goo. And he finds himself haunted. This is one of the taller ones, the 5 foot tall ones. Haunted. It's still there. Its soul is there. And its soul is not happy. And it is harassing him. And he becomes absolutely terrified, telling his family these wild stories. He ends up committed to a madhouse, and he dies. He dies. That's a true story, as far as I know, and I probably haven't told it perfectly, but it's as I recall it in the book, and you can get Kathleen's, or you can search on Kathleen Martin on unknowncountry.com and listen to the interview yourself, or get her book. She's a wonderful writer, and she's really good at what she does. She knows a thing or two. She's Betty Hill's niece, after all, and was absolutely in the room when Betty first called her mother to tell her about the incident. So she knows whereof she speaks, and she's also very articulate, brilliant woman. So if you so get all of her books and go on Amazon and look up Kathleen Marden, and you cannot go wrong. So here you have a situation very different from what's happening with Jake Barber and his friends who are shooting them and getting the bodies and having a high old time, cowboys and Indians style. Because they're not being exposed, the biological ones, the taller ones, are not exposing themselves to these cats. And I understand why not. But what happened was that this being's body was destroyed, but they are completely in control of the relationship between the soul and the body. We are trapped in our souls and in our bodies. We can't leave. Some people can. Bob Monroe, whom I met once and was a fascinating man, could leave and at times. And the Gateway place that he left in West Virginia, you can go there and learn all kinds of things about astral travel and out-of-body travel and remote viewing and things like that. But normally, we can't just leave our bodies. And they can. They can leave them easily. But they don't want the biological ones. They don't want that. And that, unlike the biorobots whose deaths don't matter, their deaths matter to them a lot, because that being in the non-physical state was furious, and I have a feeling was going to have trouble getting home. I don't know exactly what it was, or just maybe, who knows, maybe they buy bodies the way we buy cars. Who knows? And this being lost an expensive body that it had paid for. We don't know any of this stuff. It's a wonderful time, in fact, to be human. If our scientists and the academics and the Wikipedia people and all those people could just settle down and enjoy this mystery, that would be really wonderful. Now, why don't they just settle down and enjoy the mystery? I mean, I'm telling all my stories. I tell my stories as best I can, as accurately as I can, and as truthfully as I can. And I never lie, never lie. I never make things up. I never connect the dots. I try hard not to, very hard. I cannot say that what I am describing is what was really there in some absolute sense. But I can tell you this, I'm trying hard and I'm completely sincere. I am not in any way pulling people's legs or out here trying to make money off of the gullibility of others. No way. So that said, where we are with the grays now is we basically know there are at least two forms, one of which is probably completely biological or very nearly so. Another form is less so. They're more robotic, and they are, as I said, linked telepathically to the taller ones. And I think that I used to see these shorter ones in situations where there would be three of them, and then one of the taller ones would be nearby, and they eventually when the one that is on the cover of Communion eventually realized that we weren't dangerous, she would come to the house, and she would come in the house and numerous times and almost be face-to-face with us, but never quite. We even found a bedroom. Someone we could never catch was sleeping in that bedroom, because they were messing the bed up. And it was a guest room, and no one was using it. And Anne would find the bed unmade in the morning. And she would say, your friend using my bedroom and not making the bed up. So I have to make the bed up. And I couldn't make up beds, and I still can't, incidentally, although I have a duvet, so I don't have to make up my bed. I can fake make my bed by pulling up the duvet. In any case, that was quite a remarkable thing. She would come into the house, and she would kind of be there, and she would come up to the bedroom when we were asleep at night and wake me up. Sometimes I couldn't move, but there would be a relationship. It's been not been like that for a long time. When I go back to the cabin, they do come. That does happen sometimes. Not when the family's there, but when I'm there alone or with other experiencers sometimes. I've had that a couple times. They will show up briefly and very hesitantly. I have to ask myself, why is it like this? Why do they show up? Why don't they just, frankly, land on the White House lawn? Well, I can understand not wanting to land on the White House lawn, given that the U.S. is these people in the U.S. government have admitted that they shoot at them. They might think about maybe landing on the Mall in London or something like that, where they wouldn't be so likely to be shot at. I'm sure if they were landed on the White House lawn, every Secret Service officer within sight would open up immediately. But probably not if they landed in London or Paris or Berlin. So maybe even Moscow, who knows? So there was a, in any case, they don't. They're very elusive. They're very hesitant. They're very shy. Now, I got the information that if they showed up, this is when I was begging and pleading to get them on the camera here in this house, or it was long before that, actually. It was back when we still had the cabin. I was begging, please, give me a break. Just show up. A camera. Wouldn't do it. And the reason is that if they showed up for even a few seconds, our entire world would change. And we're not ready for that change. Specifically, what would happen would be our culture would end at that point and redirect itself toward them. We would be looking for technology, and I don't think we understand their technology at all. Yeah, we'll get into that in another one of these episodes. We would be looking to whether or not they were dangerous, in which I think they can be. And it would be a tremendous upheaval. And any chance of having a peaceful relationship would be ended for the foreseeable future and maybe forever. So I understand that, but I still don't like it. I still think, surely we're ready. And then I look at the Wikipedia people going all frantic because they're beginning to realize this is real, and the shock level they're in makes them push it away in such a way that they're bovarizing all of this supposed encyclopedia. Come on. They're not ready. They're not ready. And you hear the military or shooting at them. They're not ready either. They're not ready. I'm not saying that we should be a bunch of new age, all peaceful types and, oh, welcome, welcome, welcome. No. We need to hold our own and keep our own counsel. We need to be able to do that, which means that we don't rush toward them or away from them, that we stand our ground when face to face with them. And when they know we can do that, they will show up. And I hope it happens before the planet goes south on us. The reason I say that is it's possible that they would show up if the planet went south or we started a nuclear war and we're going to extinguish ourselves. And I don't think they'll be happy if they have to do that. Not at all. They will not be happy. I go into that also in A New World and again in the next two books, Them and Fourth Mind. I talk about it a lot. And I think that it's going that way because I think they probably are right about the timeline. 5 years from now, it's 2025, be 2030. And I have a feeling that we will be in pretty much in bad shape by 2030. I think there's going to be a lot of changes in the climate, very big changes. Like this year, I don't know if you've noticed it, but there have been almost continuous storms across the central United States since spring began. And that's unusual. We don't talk about it anymore because we're not supposed to, I suppose. But I talk about all kinds of things we're not supposed to talk about. That's what I do for my life, is I talk about things that nobody wants to talk about. Nobody believes, nobody wants to talk about. Most people don't believe in the soul. You know, Descartes, the great philosopher, created basically the Cartesian principle, a principle of reality that does not acknowledge anything outside of the physical world. And now we're in a prison, the Cartesian prison. We were in another prison, the religious prison, for years, the prison of superstition, where we acknowledged the numinous, but not accurately. All of those old gods and ghosts and demons and stuff, no, it wasn't real. Nor is their absence real. There's a happy medium somewhere. And when we get to that happy medium where we accept the soul and accept that there can be a science of the soul, that telepathy is real and it can be detected, and the soul is real and can be detected. When we reach that level of sensitivity, of awareness, and ability to observe our universe and our surroundings, then the visitors are going to show up. Or they're going to show up because we are falling off a cliff. One of those two things. I don't want to fall off a cliff, and I especially don't want all those beautiful young people and kids running around to fall off a cliff. I know lots of kids and teenagers, and most of the teenagers are really unhappy. They think they have no future. And I can't honestly say to them, oh my, of course you do have a future. Because I don't know that they do. I don't know that they do. I think that the political figures of this period are going to leave the most terrible legacy in history and maybe ever on this planet to those kids, if they leave those kids a world that is going to die around them and drag them down with it. Well, I can't bear that thought. Let's think of something happy. That lovely person back there in the picture, Annie, she always said the beginning of everything is joy. She said, if you really want to understand yourself and have true self-knowledge, it begins with the ability to laugh at yourself. And when you laugh at yourself, you will find very close behind that laughter, joy. So let's leave it there. Have joy. I love you. Tell your friends about this website. Tell your friends about the experience. Go ahead and tell them. Say, you know, guess what? I had a really unusual experience. And the friends that laugh at you, they're not your friends. The friends who say, wow, tell me more, they're your friends.
Thank you for listening. Dreamland is brought to you by Unknown Country and its family of subscribers. Our news editor is Matthew Frizzell. Our site coordinator is Amy Safrankova. The founder of UnknownCountry.com is Anne Strieber. I'm Whitley Strieber, your host for Dreamland.